Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:32 p.m. on Friday, February 10th. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Representative Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Vice Chair or Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Gren, and myself, Representative Co-Chair Foster, and we also have Representative Guttenberg with us. Representative Thompson is excused from committee today. Before we start, reminder, please mute your phones. And also, just a reminder for the presenters, please do not use acronyms. While they may be commonly understood in your organization, committee members and the public may not be familiar with them. At this meeting, we will hear two presentations on Alaska's economy. The first by Jonathan King, Vice President and Senior Economist, Northern Economics. Second being Dr. Ralph Townsend, Director of Social and Economic Research, which is ICER, at the University of Alaska. And if we could maybe give each presenter 45 minutes to complete their presentation, I ask members to hold your questions until the end of the presentation. If you can maybe just, if you do have a clarification question or if you have a very minor question, just you know, feel free to ask those, but we want to make sure that we allow at least 30 minutes at the end of both your presentations. We'll bring you both up here and allow for questions at that time. So if we could have Mr. King come to the table and begin your presentation and put your name on the record, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jonathan King with Northern Economics out of Anchorage. We're a 35-year-old homegrown Alaska consulting firm specializing in social sciences. And today I'm going to talk to you about our recent forecast for the Alaska economy over the next decade. I will say that we often joke in the office, particularly because we do a lot of fisheries work, that we get paid by the acronym. So if I violate your no acronym policy, please feel free to remind me, and I'll correct that. So in starting today and in talking about the state of the economy, I'm going to start with the fact that I think we all know now by now that we're in recession. And we have completed what we consider to be sort of phase one of this recession, which was caused by a collapse in oil prices, reduction in spending by the oil industry and allied sectors, and then also a reduction in state spending. So I'm going to talk about that, about how that developed, and then I'm going to talk about the timing of how we got here and really where we're headed and what is really the second phase of this recession look like. And a lot of that, the length of the second phase and the magnitude of it depends on the decisions that you as a body make. And it really comes down to how much does the state of Alaska and the consumer sector pull back having gone through the first phase of this recession. Talk a little bit about predicting recessions here in Alaska. When we talk about recessions on the national level, we think about two quarters of negative gross domestic or gross state product. In other words, the size of the economy shrinks for two quarters in a row. But here in Alaska, gross domestic, gross state product, it's not really a great measure because on a quarterly basis, the value of our economy goes up and down substantially because it's primarily attached to the value of oil production. Anybody who's been in Alaska for a long time knows that oil production declines in the summertime because that's when we do maintenance. It goes up in the wintertime because there's no maintenance and because the compressors are more efficient. And so using gross state product, the value of all the goods and services produced in the economy, is really not a very good measure on a quarterly basis. And if we did use gross state product, particularly on an annual basis, we'd have to acknowledge that we're actually in our fifth full year of recession in this state. The value of our economy actually peaked back in 2012 at $50.6 billion, and that's a combination of both the private sector and the public sector. And we've actually declined for five consecutive years. Because of a combination of, first, we had a declining production issue, an issue that we've had since 1988. And we then had an oil price collapse issue. And those have combined to take the value of our economy down. But a lot of the value of our economy, we do capture a good portion, of course, in the form of state taxes, state production taxes and royalties. But a good portion of the value of that economy goes right down the pipeline, gets on a ship, and then leaves. And so that portion doesn't hit the Alaska economy in the same way as other sectors. So what do we look for when we look for whether or not Alaska's in a recession? Well, we look for year-over-year job losses. In other words, we compare January 2017 to January 2016. So as you look at this figure, what you can see here is we have years across the bottom, and then we have whether or not we're above the gold line or below the gold line. So very simply, above the gold line, good. Below the gold line, bad, right? And so what we're looking for is for us not to be above that gold line. And so you can see that for much of the 2000s, we were above that gold line, with the exception of kind of the short, sharp shock that was the Great Recession. The Great Recession took away about 6% of all jobs in the lower 48, in the United States as a whole. Here in Alaska, we went down just over 1%, and it almost immediately came back because oil prices came back. It was a very quick retraction, and then the industry responded and came back. And so the Great Recession up here was more like a mild cold, and nothing in comparison to what we're looking at now. But you'll notice that almost as soon as we came out of that, we started to actually downslope. And even though we were above the gold line, we were growing by less and less each year. And I think that we think that this had a lot to do with, one, we saw the federal sequester, which removed a lot of money from the Alaska economy and created a headwind for the Alaska economy. We also saw slowing investment from the oil industry, right, and that also created a headwind for the economy. So those two things, even though we were growing and even though the state of Alaska had record capital budgets during that time, we were, while still growing, we were slowing down, right? So still moving forward, but at a declining rate. And you'll see that as we got towards the end of 2015, we actually went negative for the economy as a whole. So our recession, the economy started slowing all the way back in 2011. But we didn't get to the point where we stopped growing until 2015, 2016. And that's for the economy as a whole. And I'm going to talk about the individual sectors here as we go forward. The other thing, of course, is that, well, jobs are related to wages, right? We go to work and we get paid. And what you see here is this is the quarterly wages paid to Alaskans. So it's all wages and salaries. It doesn't reflect income earned by sole proprietors such as fishermen, contractors such as crew members, transfer payments such as Social Security and 401ks, 403bs, those things. But this is just wage and salary employment. What you'll see is that it's seasonal, goes up in the summertime, goes down in the wintertime. But you'll see that each year the high is a little bit higher and the low is a little bit higher, indicating a growing economy. Until we get to 2015, well, you see that we broke that trend. And we actually ended up below kind of the supporting line that you'd take if you draw a line across all of those minimums. If you go back to 2009, 2010, you'll see that we broke that line as well, but just a very little bit. But we really see a fundamental shift in the wages being earned in the economy. We also have seen a real change in household confidence. We at Northern Economics have run a quarterly confidence index since 2010. You'll see that the gold line is the entire index, and you'll see that it went up and up and up. We started at the end of the last recession, and it went up from just above 50 to actually in the quarter after the SB 21 vote, we had a peak where it went to above 60. And if you remember, we had that SB 21 vote in August, and then we had a general election, and it was right after that general election that it became very apparent to everyone that oil prices were really coming down. And we weren't going to be around that $100 range. And you can see that consumer confidence and household confidence has come down at the same time. The dark bars, the dark columns going upward, that is individuals' expectations for their state and local economy. So it's a subset of that entire Alaska Confidence Index. You'll see here again that peaked in that Q3 2014, where people felt really good. You know, we had had the SB 21 battle, and I guess there was a feeling amongst the populace that the future was bright. And then almost immediately thereafter, people realized that the future may not have been as bright as they thought it was going to be, because that's when oil prices collapsed. And their expectations for the future declined, and they fell all the way down to a reading of below 30. I think it's about 27 and a half. It's very mathematically difficult to push that any lower. You literally have to have almost everyone that answers the survey say, I think the future is worse than what it is than what it is today. And so we've seen a real drop in that. We have seen a slight recovery in that. We don't know how long that will last. U.S. consumer confidence between the third quarter and the fourth quarter went up by 20 points, which is a huge move. The economy finally started paying higher wages in the second half of the year, and there is what is being called the Trump effect on, at least initially, on confidence because of a switchover in the administration. And we'll see how long that lasts. But nationally, there has been a bump there. So we think that there might be some national influence there. I want to talk a little bit about the individual sectors in the economy. And I'm going to focus right now on the high-earning sectors in the economy of oil and gas, construction, and professional and business services. And these are three sectors that generally speaking, are high-skill, high-education jobs that are in demand. They also happen to be relatively closely aligned with the oil prices. So the first sector, of course, is the oil and gas sector. And you'll see here that we were growing here again year over year. Above the red dotted line is good. Below the dotted line is bad. Early in 2013, we were really adding a lot of oil and gas sector jobs. That slowed into 2014 as we were having the SB 21 debates and the tax debates. And then we continued then to grow again until 2015. And at the end of 2014, right to the beginning of 2015, we had record high employment in oil and gas in the state. And since then, it has been on a rapid transition downward. And so what you see is at the beginning of 2015, the growth starts to slow. That line starts to point downward. And in the middle of 2015, it transitions through that red line. And then we actually have fewer people employed in oil and gas than we did the year before. And what you continue to see is that we're still seeing declines in the oil and gas sector. But the fact that the line has turned upward means that those losses are slowing. We won't get to stabilization until that blue line comes back and touches the red line. Okay, so the important transition point here is April, May 2015, and we're still experiencing losses. Here's construction. Construction, of course, is very volatile and quite seasonal. You'll see this nice little peak with construction around 2014 due to some of the capital budgets. Then you'll see we start a downslide, and it too transitions through that red line at about the same time as the oil and gas sector. They're very closely aligned with one another because they tend to be a lot of construction activities that are directly associated with the oil and gas sector. But you actually see that they dip down and they've come back up above the red line. And we don't know if that's a permanent shift yet, if it's a data blip. These monthly numbers do get revised by Department of Labor at the end of the year. And so we're waiting for the revision of 2016 that will occur here in early 2017. But you do see the construction pop back up a little bit. And then here is my sector, which is the professional and business services sector. And you'll see that we essentially were not growing through 2013, 2014, and 2015. There are a number of firms like ours, and you know, we had very good years in 2013, 2014, and 2015 as the state was planning for the future with those large capital budgets. But a lot of us were not adding staff during that period because we knew that the state was spending at an unsustainable rate. And our employees in the professional and business services sector, they tend to be highly educated and highly trained. It costs a lot to bring them to the state of Alaska. You do not want to bring someone to the state of Alaska and spend the time and expense of moving them up here from the lower 48 only to have to dismiss them a year or two later. That is not good business practice in our sector. But you'll see that we, too, also transitioned negative in mid-2015. We as a sector, the professional business services sector, have not really started to slow our losses yet. We are still in contraction and expect to be in contraction. It's not turned yet, so we don't know when.
Thank you. I've got a clarification question on the graph, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. King, on page 5 and page 8, I mean, I get that we're in a recession. I get we're losing jobs. But what I'm trying to understand from the graphs is these are supposed to be year over year. And, if it was just one point in time, I could tell. But, on page 5, with the numbers going up and down and up and down and up and down, I don't understand how that's year over year. It's too hard for me to follow. And then the same thing on page 8. So, are we losing 15% at that lowest point on page 8 from when? And I don't understand how the lines work.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Guerra, it's monthly year over year, right? So we're comparing each point on the graph, each little kink in the graph is, say, January compared to January. So I think a good example of this was there was recently a...
I get it.
Okay, you got it? Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll keep it short and sweet.
Can I just slip in a quick question there, though?
Representative Ortiz, clarification?
Clarification. The construction or manufacturing has jumped back up above the 0 point.
You didn't specifically say why. Do we know why it did that?
Through the chair, Representative, we don't know specifically why at this point. It is the very last data point that we have that has brought that up above. I mean, clearly there's a trend where you can see it's a U-shape and it's starting to come back up. We are or had been seeing increased federal spending, at least until the inauguration, where we saw a lot of federal spending kind of come to a halt there. But we think that could be related to F-35s in Fairbanks, that has provided some lift up in there, and that is helping to insulate kind of the interior economy, particularly in construction. That growth in Fairbanks for the F-35s is going to be probably the largest outside driver of construction in the state for the next couple of years, and is helping insulate the Fairbanks area right now.
I'm feeling these clarification questions are turning into substantive questions here. Is that a clarification question?
No. Representative Guerra? Thank you, Chair. No, it's really a clarification question. You know, I guess job numbers would be easier to follow. So if you have, are you saying, let's just look at the construction one. Are you saying that in mid-2015, that was a 5% decrease in jobs compared to the year ago, and then in mid-2016, that's a 8% loss in jobs compared to the year ago. And then that last point in time, maybe a 2.5%, that's a 2.5% increase to a year ago, but still way less jobs than many years ago, right?
That is, through the chair, that is exactly how to interpret this. You have to compare it to you have to compare it to 12 points prior. And so I'm not trying to show you at this time total jobs in the economy. What I'm trying to show you is the evolution of how we transitioned into recession. And I think that's a very important distinction. And at the end of your prior question, there was an article recently in the Dispatch News within the last week that said that we lost 9,000 jobs in the third quarter, was the headline. That was the wrong interpretation of what that data showed. Really, what that data said was, compared to the third quarter in 2015, there were 9,000 fewer jobs in the Alaska economy in the third quarter of 2016. So what we're talking about right now is not total jobs. We're talking about watching the relative health of the sectors. And we're going to, as we transition through the presentation, I'm going to switch over to the total number of jobs, which I think will make it a little bit easier. So, okay to move ahead, Mr. Chairman?
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. So I want to talk now about state employment and retail. The red circle, remember, is where the high-earning sectors transitioned into recession. So what we're looking for here again is when do these sectors cross the red line? Okay, so here we go. Retail grew all the way through 2013, all the way 2014, 2015 grew, had this nice little bump up in 2016, and then started to come down, and really just transitioned to recession for that sector alone at the end of 2016. As it happened, I was on the plane this morning. I happened to sit next to an individual who works for one of the major retailers in the state. We talked about this, and he said this morning that the first quarter of 2017 will be the first quarter of 2017 will be the first quarter in 160 quarters that his company has lost money in the state of Alaska. So that's the first time in 16 years that they will lose money. So that tells you, yes, this graph, retail employment has come down, the earnings are coming down, the retail sector is feeling it. Well, why is that important? Well, the retail sector is not a primary sector of the economy. It doesn't bring money into the state of Alaska. It's what people do with their money after they've earned it in the oil and gas sector or the transportation sector or the sectors that bring money into the economy. So it's a secondary effect of the economy. So this tells us that the contagion is starting to spread from the primary sectors to where people are starting to spend it. Okay. So the next line here is state government. There's the green dot for that. Let's put on the line for state government. And here's state government, largely flat. There's this little spike in 2014 that could be a data error. And then you start to see that actually state government started to contract right after the governor's inauguration in 2014, and has continued to contract, and it's contracting in a different way than the private sectors. It's slower, it's more measured, and the reason for that, of course, is that if you're in state government, you do budgeting once a year, and you don't just fire everybody that has to go in July. You make your budget last as long as you can, and then the person gets dismissed. So what the figure for the line of state government is not saying that we've lost 5% of all government jobs. What it's saying is for that long duration is that we're losing jobs at the equivalent of 5% per year. And the longer that stays at that level, that's a 5% per year loss that's occurring annually.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
So I thought you were talking about retail, we were talking about money spent. So are you talking about state government, state employment jobs, and retail jobs?
Correct.
Okay.
They're shown on the same. And these are jobs. These are not positions. I think it's very important. One of the things that we hear frequently is, well, those aren't real jobs. Those are positions that were unfilled. That's incorrect. The Department of Labor only counts jobs. They count employed people as measured through unemployment insurance. You only pay unemployment insurance when you have a body sitting in the seat. So these are real people losing real jobs, not positions eliminated. So we've got one last slide like this. Here's our dots. Again, remember the red is the three high earning sectors. Green is retail. The bluey purple there is state employment. And then let's look at healthcare. This is the one growth sector really in the economy. I would say that we did have a small uptick last year in tourism. The recovery in the U.S. economy is sending more lower 48 residents our way. That is a relatively lower earning sector than healthcare. It also is not something that is driven by our own economy in particular, with the exception of the fact that Alaskans recreate a lot, and we do spend a lot of money in the tourism sector. But I want to really focus here on healthcare. This is the largest wage and salary sector in the economy. There's 50,000 Alaskans employed in private healthcare in Alaska. Other than commercial fishing, which is not a wage and salary sector, it tends to be private contractors and sole proprietors, this is the largest employer inside of our economy at this point. And you'll see that towards the end of 2016, you'll see that the line is flat and then it kinks up to the right. That kink is the governor's Medicaid expansion decision and the money that flowed into the economy and the hiring that occurred immediately thereafter as federal funds started to flow into the economy. So that has driven that number upward. So I'd like to switch over now to where are we headed. And there's two basic things that really determine economic robustness: money coming in and money going out. Rich economies, wealthy economies, bring money in from other places and they hold on to it. And a good example of that, I think, for us as Alaskans to understand is think about Seattle. Seattle has done a great job of bringing money in, some of it from Alaska and our fisheries, and storing it there and providing the services there, and they're very wealthy. When we are selling a lot of oil and the price of oil is good, we're very good at bringing money into this economy. And we're very good at capturing a portion of that for using to fund state services. We are not very good as an economy at keeping the money inside because we don't make a lot of things here. Go to our stores, particularly retail stores, go to the bush, go to a store in the bush and find something that was made in that community. The fact of the matter is that most of it wasn't. And when you give when a dollar flows in income to somebody who lives in a very small village, and then they go to their village store and they spend it, 80 cents of that dollar immediately leaves the state's economy. It goes out to the fuel provider, it goes out as cost of goods sold, and only 20 cents remains in the economy to circulate again. So a good multiplier in the lower 48, where economies tend to be more connected, they tend to be closer together, is that a dollar will circulate two and a half times. In rural Alaska, it's $1.20. In the urban areas, it's probably closer to $1.60, $1.70, depending on what the sector is. So we leak money like a sieve. We don't do a good job of holding that in. And when we lose the money coming in from the oil sector, we feel that very quickly because the other sectors start to tamp down. I won't spend a lot of time on the three-legged stool because I think a lot of you have been through this before, but we all know, I think at this point, or I hope we know, that the three big drivers, the things that bring money into our economy, are the federal government, right? Education, healthcare, direct employment, construction money. The oil industry, and that comes in through direct industry investment and our own state revenues, right? So we capture a portion of that and reinject it into the economy. And then there's everything else. There's fishing, there's tourism, there's air transport, there's mining. My company happens to have an office in Ballard. When we do work in Seattle or the Pacific Northwest and bring that money home, then we fit into this everything else group. Okay? And we know that our stool is a little wobbly. I've stolen a slide from Dr. Townsend just here, and he's going to talk about this more, but I think you know as House Finance that in the budget context we have roughly a $3 billion gap. If you were to take the earnings reserve, that's the ER there, and the constitutional budget reserve, that's the CBR there, and put them together and use it kind of the endowment model, then you could, and take off 4.5% a year, then you could take off $2.7 billion and fill the budget gap relatively easily with the $300 million left over. Now, of course, no PFD if you do that. So the long-run gap is really that $300 million plus whatever you decide to pay out in the PFD, of course, assumes a constant size of government expenditures into the unrestricted general fund. So what we've done in preparation for this is we have done some dynamic forecasting with what we call the Alaska REMI model. And to say this as easily as possible is that this is a very big mathematical model that represents all the interlinkages between all the different sectors in the Alaska economy. Okay? So if I spend money as an oil services firm or I spend money as a medical firm, all of those coefficients, the numbers are all linked together. What makes this special is it's also linked to a demographic cohort model. So we know the structure of the Alaska populace by age, gender, and by ethnicity. And so what this allows us to do is to shock the economy. So we essentially have a model that represents the Alaska economy. It's something that we've spent a lot of time and money customizing over the last couple of years. And so we're able to say, okay, you want a tax? Here's the tax. Here's the effect that it has. You want to take out 2,500 soldiers from J-Bear. Here's the effect that it has on Anchorage, Mat-Su, and the rest of the state. And we can actually see that over time. So unlike other models, which only look, say, a year in advance or a shock it, the interesting thing about this model is that essentially we poke the economy and then we watch how it responds over a number of years. And you can actually go out as far as 50 years. And we've used this for Shell Offshore, when Shell was looking at offshore, the effect on the Alaska economy. What we've called the big gas pipeline, it's gone under several names over the last decade, but we've used it for those. We've been on the team for that, for Susitna-Watonna. We've done some recession policy forecasting, and we've also done it for J-Bear and the force reduction at J-Bear. So we actually did, back in 2015, we did some fiscal policy forecasting, and this is one of the scenarios that we ran, and this is total employment. So this is wage and salary employment plus the self-employed. So I think that that total employment number, it's important to point that out. When ADOLWD and when ICER do employment forecasting, they do wage and salary employment forecasting. And there's about 365,000 wage and salary jobs in the Alaska economy. There's an additional 100,000 jobs that are not wage and salary. These are people that are the sole proprietors. They can be doctors. They can be the people that put the floor in your house. They can be a fisherman. They can be a crew member. Okay? They basically, they take care of themselves and don't pay unemployment insurance. So we put those two together, which is what the Bureau of Economic Analysis does for the federal government. And when we did this model run back in 2015, you'll see here that we expected 2013 and 2014. We had that data. That's why they're dark blue, that we would go up. And then in 2015, the recession would hit and we would come down. And we expected the recession to continue until around 2020, and that we would lose from that 460,000 job level down to just over the 440,000 job level. We thought that we would lose essentially 15,000 to 18,000 jobs, and then we would come back up. Well, why would we come back up, right? In order to come back up, we have to have stimulus in the economy. Somebody has to spend money. So that has to be either, in our case, the federal government spends more money, or oil prices go back up, or production goes back up, and the oil industry spends more, and then the state captures more and injects it back into the economy. In this case, that recovery was the assumption that the big gas pipeline would be built. That V shape right there, or the mild U shape, whichever one we want to think of it as, that is the stimulus of the building of the big gas pipeline. Okay, so this is old forecasting that we did. Here's what's actually happened. 2013, 2014, that was already given in the model. 2015 was a much better year than we predicted. The Alaska economy was more durable in 2015 than we thought. But here for 2016, you'll see that our predicted number and the actual employment number were only off by a couple thousand. So basically the difference between our prediction that we made for 2016 and the actuals, the difference is less than 1%. So the recession is essentially going forward as we predicted at this point. So for this presentation, when we originally received the invitation from Senate Labor and Commerce, we decided that we would run some scenarios for the legislature as bookends, not to support specific policies, but just to give you an idea of what the future might look like under different scenarios. So we've run four scenarios. We run a status quo scenario, which we had not had time to run when we gave our Senate presentation 3 weeks ago, which presumes that you continue to spend around $4.2 billion in the unrestricted general fund, that you're spending from reserves, and you continue to have APFD of roughly the size of what we had last year. We know that that's unsustainable spending, right? That's kind of the pie in the sky. You could do it. We have enough money to do it. You would endanger, in the long run, the corpus of the permanent fund without a recovery in either oil prices or changing the tax structure on the oil industry.
We've got a clarification question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. When you say assuming the permanent fund dividend we had last year, you mean the actual one or what would have been without the veto?
I mean the $1,000 one, because that's what's built into the model. Thank you. Sorry. So the second scenario is that we have a, f- a $4.2 billion unrestricted general fund, but we have a reduced dividend, and instead of that money from the money that was set aside from the reduced dividend getting put into essentially staying in the earnings reserve, it now goes in to feed the economy, right? It goes into spending on government services as opposed to going out as a dividend. Then we have scenario two, which here again is another $4.2 billion unrestricted general fund and a broad-based tax. So this is to give you the idea of the difference between having broad-based taxes and reducing income through broad-based taxes and reducing income via reduction in the dividend. And then the last scenario is a 3.2 unrestricted general fund, the full payout of the PFD, which would be, to Representative Guerra's question, the historical payout of the full normalized calculation that happens every year by the permanent fund division, no taxes, and we essentially have a $500 million step down over 2 years. I think it's really important to say, like a lot of us who live a semi-public life, been mischaracterized in the media. We do not advocate for any of these, right? We're not trying to advocate. We're trying to help you make a better decision. That's our role. And so we're not here to say, pick one. We're here to say, these are the effects of these different options.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
So on scenario number one, when you're saying a reduced dividend, is that reduced from the $1,000 or reduced from what we thought there would be?
Through the chair, this is the question I believe that Representative Guerra asked. This is maintaining that $1,000.
Also in scenario one would also be the $1,000.
Yes. So let me revise that. The status quo would be the normalized payout, and the scenario one is the reduced dividend. Okay, so last year, if we were running this last year, status quo would have been a $2,000 payout, and scenario one would have been a $1,000 payout. So the model actually predicts 2016 because we didn't have full year data. So let's back it up to 2015, right? The status quo presumes $1,800 or $2,024 or whatever it was, that's status quo. Reduced dividend is $1,000 under scenario one. And I thank you for asking the clarification questions because it is important going forward.
In scenario number two, are we talking about a dividend in scenario number two, or is there just no dividend in scenario number two?
There is a substantially reduced dividend in scenario number two, down below the $1,000. So yeah. It's I think that we removed over $1 billion in income in that. So if you normally would have had if you need a $1.4 billion payout, there would have been some dividend there, but it's really substantially reduced to below the $500 level.
And just to be mindful of time, looks like we're on slide 16 of 23, and we've got technically about 5 more minutes, but we can go over a little longer, but my concern is I just don't want to eat into Dr. Townsend's time too much, so if we could just maybe be mindful of that. Thank you.
I will roll forward quickly. So very quickly, caveats and assumptions. I think the most important thing here is no strong oil price recovery. The government expenditures, the $4.2 billion and the $3.2 billion, those are in nominal dollars. Okay, so it assumes that I spend $4.2 billion this year and $4.2 billion next year. Anybody familiar with inflation knows that that means that government actually shrinks in the years going forward by the rate of inflation. And there's some additional assumptions about no big economic movers. In other words, we've taken out the big gas pipeline. And I acknowledge that the future will be different than whatever it is that I say it will be today, because that's how the world works. And just in comparison to other forecasts very quickly, I already talked about the job issue that we talk about jobs as BEA talks about jobs, which is the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which is wage and salary plus self-employed. If you look at our numbers versus the ADOLWD numbers, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, that they forecast wage and salary. And all of those three institutions, Northern Economics, the Institute for Social and Economic Research, and the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, we are all roughly saying the same thing for 2017, right? We're all in broad agreement. Where we diverge is that Northern Economics, because we are not a state entity, we have the ability to model in the future. We don't have the danger, the political danger of getting in front of the governor or the legislature because we don't work for the governor or the legislature, so we can do that. So 2017 through 2026, here's the employment forecast. And this is where we talked about the difference between phase one and phase two. So all the forecasts are the same essentially through 2017 because there's no difference in policy, right? And so then we have that dotted line, which is, let's presume that you could do the status quo. If that were the case, the recession, we would have this year of recession, and then the economy would largely stabilize. Because we've gone through the contraction in the oil industry, we've gone through the contraction in state government, and state government spending, which is the thing that is contracting now, would stabilize, we would have the same average over a number of years, and we would go from having a peak employment of about 465,000 in 2015 down to about down to just something north of 445,000. So we're, no matter what we do, even under the best case scenario, we're talking about losing 15 to 20,000 jobs out of the economy. Okay? The next layer down is if you have a broad-based tax or a really significant reduction in the permanent fund, there's not a lot of difference there. There isn't much daylight between those. That being said, there's a lot of functional difference on the ground. If I'm living in a relatively rural area where the PFD is a large portion of the income, or if I don't have a high-earning job, then clearly I prefer an income tax to a reduction of my PFD, and vice versa. If I'm a well-paid individual that lives in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, the Valley, the Mattsu Valley, I would prefer that you take my PFD than if you take income tax. But we don't see that much difference in terms of the aggregate effect on the overall economy. Now, the $3.2 billion unrestricted general fund, the step down in state spending in order to keep the PFD, that significantly reduces the overall employment. And the reason for that is, instead of taking a little bit of income from everyone, we're going to directly slice a significant number of jobs from the economy, and those people will struggle to find jobs, and they will not spend. And so for every one state employee or largely attached to the state employee economy we remove between another 0.6 and 0.7 jobs in the private sector economy. So losing 10 state employees, eventually you're going to lose 6 to 7 private sector employees as the money that the state employees would have spent filters through the economy. And this goes to speaking to the work that Dr. Gutabi did last year at ICER, which showed that which essentially showed that reduction of state employment is the most detrimental option with regards to overall employment, because those people will just simply stop spending money. So one way I think about this is, if you have a little bit less income, maybe you wait to replace that dishwasher, or I don't know, the dishwasher is pretty important. You might choose to replace that one, but maybe you choose not to paint the house, or you delay the replacement of the car a year, but you're still in the economy and you're still paying taxes and you're still going to a restaurant, maybe just not one as fancy. When you remove somebody completely from the economy, they're gone, and those expenses are gone. In looking at the population forecasts, without some additional expenditures, we do expect to see a net negative effect on population starting in this year. In other words, out-migration and deaths will overwhelm our natural reproductive rate. In fact, our natural reproductive rate may slow as the economy gets worse. And there is some minor PFD effect on Alaskans' reproductive rate, although it's relatively small. You'll see that for the 3.2, the other scenarios, there isn't a big difference in the population forecast. And the reason for that is that population is very sticky, right? If I have dedicated myself to living in a place, and we have to admit that Americans are a very highly mobile society, if I have dedicated myself to living somewhere and the grandparents are there and my kids are in school, or I have historic heritage here, and my family has been here for 10,000 years, I'm going to try and stay. And so the population effects take longer than the economic effects. Okay, so that's just simply there. This is the summary slide. Basically, in summary, the status quo, we lose 13,000, 15,000 jobs. Scenarios 1 and 2, which are the dividend cut and the broad-based taxes, we've got another couple years of recession to go, and it's 24,000 to 25,000 jobs. You go for that cut and larger cut in what's remaining in state government, and you end up with losses around 33,000 jobs. Come over to population, the status quo, we'd probably lose 13,000 residents, is what the model says. The other ones, there's minor differences between them, but we're looking at losing 30,000 people out of a 700,000 person state. So I know I'm out of time, so I'll just say for key takeaways is that mathematically, and you guys know this, mathematically solving the fiscal gap is not an issue. My seventh grader can do this, and it's not a problem. The resources are really there. But the expectations gap, and you know this in hearing from the public, the expectations gap is huge, and the hardest myths to bust are those we tell about ourselves, right? I don't need to exercise more. I don't need to lose weight. I'm a really good writer. I can dance like nobody's business, right? I mean, those are the things that when we realize that those things are not true about ourselves, they are the hardest to overcome. And we have two generations of Alaskans, particularly those who are born here, who have never lived in an economy where they consistently pay taxes. They're not trained. They're not used to doing that. And that is one of the biggest things that we have to, as a society, get over. And that is an incredible challenge. So my last slide in key takeaways is just that without stimulus or spending stabilization, we have 2 to 3 years left in recession. And as a business owner, as somebody who makes daily decisions for 15 employees and their families and buys health insurance, it's a terrifying time right now. It's really, really scary. The size of this second phase of the recession is really going to be dependent upon the signals that you send as a group and the decisions that you make. In some ways, we're almost getting to the point where you simply making a decision and providing some certainty to the populace is as important as the decision that you make in and of itself. Because right now, as a business owner, there's no way I can hire anybody here. I can't do it. I can't do it, especially if I have to bring them from somewhere else. Because I cannot reasonably say that there's a future, you know, or that the future can support the businesses in the size that they are. So that's a bit of a personal aside, but I think it speaks true to what's going on. All right, and the last point I've already made, which is that people without jobs are more likely to sell their homes and leave, whereas reducing everyone's income leaves us poorer, but it generally leaves the economy intact. I know I've run over time. I just want to say thank you on behalf of the entirety of Northern Economics, all 14 of us. I couldn't fit everybody's picture here. But only one of us presents, but you are looking at the combined efforts of a very dedicated and highly trained group of people who are really thrilled to have the opportunity to speak to the legislature, really for the first time in 35 years of working in the state. So thank you for having us.
Thank you so much, Mr. King, for your presentation. With that, we'll take a brief at ease and allow Dr. Townsend to come up and get set. And then at the end of his presentation, we'll bring both of you to the table for questions from the committee. Thank you. At ease.
order. Welcome. Would you put introduce yourself to the record?
Good afternoon. I'm Ralph Townsend. I'm the director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Representative Seaton and members of the committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you today. On the first slide, you will notice in the small print that you probably can't read, at least I can't read it from here, there's a disclaimer that says whatever I say as a faculty and staff member at the university does not in any way reflect the policies of the university, nor even the policies of ICER, it says. And that is because in public education we have a long tradition of making the resources of our faculty and staff available to the public and independent of the institution itself. And that disclaimer really reflects that long tradition of having staff and faculty present their opinions unobtruded by the perspectives of chancellors and presidents. I should say by two additional pieces of the disclaimer, though. One is that we at ICER do try to maintain neutrality in what we do. We try not to advocate for specific legislation. We do try to be clear about what we think the impacts are going to be, but we try to, as much as possible, separate our opinions. I say try because we all bring our perspectives to these things, and I appreciate that. The last disclaimer I want to make, however, is personal, very personal, and that is that I arrived in Alaska in August of this year. I do not have the experience or the length of experience in Alaska that you are used to from Vic Pierce and Scott Goldsmith or Gunnar Knapp. I apologize. And there are certainly gaps in my institutional knowledge of Alaska. There are going to be details that I won't have and may even get wrong. And where I don't know, I try to say I don't know rather than guessing. So having said that, I wanted to try to do two things in this presentation. When I talked with the staff about what to do, the first is to try to conceptualize what's the nature of the problem that we face, the overall problem. And then the second one was the staff, based on a presentation that I did at State Affairs, was quite interested in having me go over some material on taxes, to some extent on spending, but particularly what I might call technical issues around taxes, their impact, design, and so forth. So I'll do those two things. The first piece is to talk about how we conceptualize where we're at. And I, unfortunately, I'm a professor by training. I haven't been in the classroom for 10 years, but it never goes away. And the first thing I want to say is that at a very high level, I think of what's going on in Alaska as a change in how we manage four key resources. Those four key resources, obviously oil and gas, has been very important to the state. Over time, the state has built up this tremendous financial asset in the form of the permanent fund, the earnings reserve, the constitutional budget reserve, and a couple of other smaller reserves. The third asset that you have been largely responsible for managing is the infrastructure, the roads, the ports, the airports that we have built over the last 20 and 30 years. And finally, a piece to remember is that the most important asset in any modern economy is the human capital. The people, the training, the investments in health, and that obviously connects to our educational system, but it's broader than that. It also connects to things like building resilient court systems. If you look around the world and say, why is it you go to a developing country, it's chaotic sometimes. Well, they haven't figured out how to build a court system. That requires a kind of institutional development that we have invested in over a long period of time. Now, what happened was for Alaska, for a very long period of time, we know that oil resource generates a very unstable flow of revenues. But that really wasn't a problem for a long time because the minimum that it generated was enough for us to make most of the investments we needed in item four, human capital. And we dealt with the variations by putting the large when we got large surpluses, we put it into the financial assets, and we put them into the physical infrastructure in the form of capital budget. And we were able to some extent, draw on the financial assets. But largely, we simply needed to worry about how do we allocate the oil resources we have between the other three major assets. Now, what has been happening, and which we knew about, but we didn't really worry about too much, was that asset number one, the oil reserves, are declining in their present value. The amount we're going to get in the future from oil is much lower than it was in 1980. That asset has really been going down. At the same time, the financial assets, thanks to the foresight of folks like yourself, that asset has been going up. We're now at a point where the revenue from the oil resource, that unpredictability is a problem. The minimum flow is no longer enough to do the things we want to do. And so we've now got a more complicated problem, and that is we need to manage both the financial resource as well as the oil resource, and we suddenly realize the financial assets actually have variability in them as well. The crash in 2008-2009 substantially affected the revenues that we get from those financial resources. So the problem has become more complicated, both because, yes, the level of income from the oil resources is falling, but the variability is more problematic, and we now have to worry about managing the financial asset as well. Jonathan did an excellent job of setting up the economic context. Let me just quickly summarize what he said, and that was that we have a moderate recession that started in late 2015 and is now forecast to go at least through 2017 and probably into early 2018. And that's, as Jonathan said, ICER reaches exactly the same conclusion using slightly different models, as does the Department of Labor. And as Jonathan indicated, it is clear that state budget decisions will affect the length of that recession and the severity. What 2018 and 2019 look like will depend to a substantial extent on what happens in terms of budget decisions with the state budget. That is, I think, changes our how we think about the problems that we face. I would say one thing about this particular forecast is that I think it's a little clearer than it perhaps was a year or 18 months ago about what the future is like, and it's just a slight bit worse. And that has the fact that we're closer to it and it's a little bit worse has made it clearer to all of us that the decisions we're making about the state budget do need to consider what is going on in the broader economy. To set the context, I know that many of you heard from your constituents, whether it's from your local regional development corporations, from major businesses, from community civic groups, that they're asking that the government here in Juneau come up with a plan. And by plan, they mean some sort of a multi-year plan. And I want to try to explain from their perspective why a plan is important. Now, a plan is important because I think from people who understand our current economic context recognize that there are both risks, and those risks Jonathan has already set out for you, so I really don't need to go over those. There are some real risks to our economy. And people can see that if we make or are forced to make very large 1 or 2 year adjustments, it's going to have a dramatic impact. But the second piece is Alaska's in the very fortunate situation of having the opportunity, given by its large savings accounts, to manage this transition. So there's the opportunity to use our resources and to think ahead. This is a multi-year issue. It's not balancing the budget this year. It's not even balancing the budget this year and next year. It's a 5 to 10 year period. It's a dynamic problem. Even policy wonks like myself, who are used to looking at spreadsheets full of numbers, appreciate that getting in your head what's happening under 10 different things over the next 10 years is hard to get your head around. So as a teacher, when I go into my class, because I have taught economics, I say, how do I get this down to a way that, how do I pick something that people can understand? And as I've made presentations over the last couple of months, this is my latest try, and that's what it is. And that is to use the earnings reserve, the ER here, the earnings reserve, as a way to conceptualize what our issue is about. I use the earnings reserve because while it's possible for the state to modify its constitution, anything is possible, to go beyond the earnings reserve, the fact is that if the earnings reserve goes to zero, it's going to cause, I think at a minimum, severe political problems, and probably severe economic problems. So I say, let's pick a point and say, let's look at scenarios around what is going to happen to the earnings reserve. And again, looking at it from someone from outside, I think we're at a point where it's fair to say that it's essentially inevitable we're going to draw some from the earnings reserve. And that's not said openly as much, but I think it's clear that we are at the point, we're looking out 2 or 3 years, there are really not scenarios where we don't draw some from the earnings reserve. And so the question becomes, will that draw be ad hoc? Will it just be whatever happens, or will it be planned? What is the risk that that path of earning draws, whether they're planned or whether they're just whatever happens, what is the risk that it will take us to or near zero for the earnings reserve? And what would happen if the earnings reserve balance gets near that zero level? What sort of adjustments would we be able to make depending on how we've gotten there? Quite candidly, I think there are a number of strategies that run substantial risks that within 10 years we could be looking at the scenario of the earnings reserve being at or near to zero. Takes a little bad luck, but bad luck is part of the future here. Again, with a little good luck, oil prices come back to $80, wonderful. But I think betting on sort of the most likely scenarios, there are substantial risks that we could get there. And I think when people think about those ways, they say, well, maybe this is a way to think about it. As we're steering this path forward, is it steering us towards this, I think, problematic point for us at least, or is it moving us away from that in some way that we can understand, and is it giving us some control over our future? Well, if you look at that dynamic path that way, you reach two sort of ideas come into your head. The first one is, while planning can help us reduce the probability, it may not be able to completely reduce it. Really bad luck in the financial markets and oil prices cannot be completely ruled out. But planning can help us manage and substantially reduce the probability that we get to the point where the earnings reserve is near or at zero. And secondly, that planning, even if we're getting close, planning will allow us to make adjustments as we get close to avoid that outcome. And I think that's why it's that idea of being able to manage our future that encourages many in the civic community to say, let's get a plan out there. The second piece is one that I'm not sure everyone appreciates, so I go out of my way to make it, and that is one of the reasons that businesses are saying we need a plan is that it's fairly clear, I think, to businesses in general, that there are going to be adjustments in spending. There are going to be adjustments in one of the following: spending, taxes, the PFD. There's going to be some combination. It could be large in one of them and small in the other two, but there's going to be some combination. But here's the real point. Those various cuts and taxes will have different impacts on different businesses. And the last thing you want is every business worrying about the worst-case scenario. By setting a plan out there, people can say, well, it's not good for me, but I can plan for it, where other businessmen are saying, well, I can move ahead. And let me just mention sort of two or three things. This is not intended to be exhaustive, but to give you a sense of what I mean about different impacts. If you're a business that sells large electronic goods, for example, you should be quite worried about the sales tax, particularly if it's at 6 or 7%, because you will face internet competition. You already do, and the sales tax will be a further disadvantage. I think it's clear to everyone. If there's a large PFD cut, if you're a rural business that depends on customers whose income comes substantially from the PFD, you're going to be more affected than businesses who don't rely on the PFD. Businesses recognize also that if, for example, a decision is made to reduce support for K-12 education, to move the cost back to the community, this is going to have an impact on local businesses. Again, local businesses have two taxes in this state, sales and property taxes, but in many communities, it's going to result in higher property taxes. Well, higher property taxes are particularly bad for companies that make large fiscal plant investments. If you're a company that has millions of dollars invested in infrastructure and relatively small number of employees, then property taxes can be a very substantial part of your operating costs. And so a decision, if you're thinking about moving into a community where potentially the property tax could increase 50% or 100%, that's a big issue looking ahead. Finally, Jonathan King has already indicated to you that if there's no capital budget going ahead, firms like his, the professional services businesses, are going to make employment decisions that say, well, if there's not going to be a capital budget, the size of my firm has got to be adjusted to reflect that. So those are examples of what I mean by the cuts are going to affect businesses differently, and they'd like to know what the future looks like. Let me make one footnote here. And this is a footnote, by the way, that Jonathan touched on. I know you've seen some forecasts under various scenarios of budgeting, and I've seen them done in a variety of places around the web. There are models is really the wrong word, sort of spreadsheets that do the accounting. And I want to put in a caution because this, I think, has been a serious problem in some of the discussions, and that is inflation needs to be treated identically in revenues and expenditures. And what I mean by that is that when you look at the projections for earnings from the permanent fund, tax revenues, oil revenues, and government spending, they all need to either assume the same rate of inflation or no inflation. It can all be done in the same rate of inflation, assuming 2% a year or whatever, and you'll get the right answer. They can all be done in real terms, that is, assume no inflation, and you'll get the same answer. But if some are nominal and some are real, you're going to get the wrong answer. Economists typically do our calculations in real terms and I'll tell you why we do that. It's not because we like funny money, which many people see it as, but if I tell you something costs $100 in 2016 dollars or 2017 dollars, you know what I'm talking about. If I tell you something's going to cost $100 in 2025 dollars, what does that tell you? Well, you can figure it'll buy less, but I'm not sure how much less, right? And I have this example, by the way, when I used to teach, I'd tell students, you know, my dad calls candy bars nickel candy bars. Do you know why he calls them nickel candy bars? And it blows their mind that you could have bought a candy bar for a nickel, right? So, and here's the problem that has frequently happened, and Jonathan touched on it. In the calculations I've seen, people use the 6.9% rate of return on the permanent fund in predicting permanent fund payout. That clearly includes inflation. That is above a long-term real rate of return that can be achieved by a fund of this size. They take the state revenue forecasts that are growing slowly, oil prices growing slowly. Those are clearly nominal figures. Then they say state government spending is going to be flat in nominal terms. Well, flat spending in nominal terms means every time you show up at the legislature every year, you need to cut 2% of the services that are being provided. And so you have to be careful about that. That if you think about it, you say, oh, what's 2%? Well, 2% over 10 years is 20%. On a $4 billion budget, that's $800 million. So flat funding state government for the next 10 years is pretty similar to taking $800 million out today. You take it out the whole period, but at the end, you're going to be in about the same place. So I just make that footnote because I've seen this mistake made repeatedly, and I think when you look at these forecasts, the first thing to ask someone is this real or nominal, or have they all done the same? By the way, someone in a footnote to this said, you know, one of the problems is that I can't figure out what's going on in inflation. What are the assumptions in the permanent fund? How did they get to 6.9%? And it's not always easy to do this. It's not a trivial exercise to make sure you've got consistent assumptions across the various sources of data. The second piece decided to, or was asked to do in this discussion, was to talk about things to consider, what I might call technical issues in tax design as we think about different tax policies, the PFD or spending cuts, but particularly focused on taxes. And if there's nothing else that I leave you with today, this slide is the one that summarizes economists' overall assessment of good tax policy, and that is broad and low. What do I mean by that? It's better to have an income tax that includes all the income at 2% than it is to have an income tax that has loopholes for 50% and therefore has a 4% tax rate. There's two reasons for that. The first reason is if you create loopholes, everybody wants to be in them. And the second thing is the higher the tax rate, the more it pays you to go looking for the loopholes. So broad and low means that the tax system does not distort decisions that people are making. That is the thinking behind broad and low. Quickly, when you think about taxes, obviously a tax moves money from the private sector to the government. But there are costs beyond, let's say, $100 million collected in taxes. There are costs beyond that. One is obvious, and this is one that I hear discussed a lot, and that is you've got to set up a government agency to collect the taxes. You're all familiar with the at least with my experience on April 14th every year, I've got 6 or 8 hours of collecting receipts around the house to put together my tax. Those are obvious compliance costs, but I want to tell you those are not the most substantial cost of a tax system. The more substantial cost is that people spend resources to avoid taxes. A silly one, but real, one state in the Midwest once imposed a tax on livestock as of March 1. March 27th, a whole bunch of livestock trucks drive into the state, load all the livestock, drive to the next state, bring them back on March 3rd. Laugh about it. There are plenty of examples like that. By the way, one of the places they will spend resources to reduce taxes is on lobbyists to come in front of legislators and administrative agencies to have them treated preferentially. And this is non-trivial, by the way, because it's not just the lobbyist time. For every hour you see the lobbyist in front of you, there are dozens of hours with the CEO and the CFO. And that's the real cost of that kind of lobbying. And it's part of our system, but the higher the tax rate, the greater the incentive is to spend the money on those kinds of things. And finally, people change what they do to avoid taxes. And the best example in the U.S. has been the very strong preference for investments in housing. Individuals get, as you know, the deductibility of property taxes and interests affect individual ownership. But for a long time, there has been a very favorable depreciation policy with respect to residential housing, which has encouraged investment in residential housing. And most people would say that part of the issue of the housing, not all by any means, but part of the issue with the housing crash was actually that we had encouraged too much of it in part through our tax policies. So I want to emphasize that these costs, the decisions people make to avoid taxes, to reduce taxes, are a very important part and are more important than the obvious administrative costs. The second thing that I would emphasize in my little tax policy discussion is that, unfortunately, equity and efficiency are often in conflict in tax policy. The things that will reduce the broad social cost of tax policy often are things that result in what we might think of as inequitable distributions of the burden of taxation. And that is just an unfortunate fact of the way taxes occur. And think back to my broad and low example. You say, well, I want to deal with the equity issue, so I'm going to not tax this. Well, now you're moving towards higher taxes on a smaller base. So that is what I mean by the trade-off between equity and efficiency. When we talk about equity, it's usually the case that people use the word regressive versus progressive taxes. I'll just quickly define what those are. Let me define what a progressive tax is first. In a progressive tax, if your income doubles, your taxes more than double. So if your income goes from $100,000 to $200,000, if you're paying $5,000 in taxes, you're paying more than $10,000 when you get to the $200,000. A regressive tax is one in which when your income doubles, your taxes do not double. So if you're paying $5,000 with $100,000 of income and you're paying $7,000 with $200,000, the percentage of your income going into taxation falls. That would be a regressive tax. Notice that in a regressive tax, higher income people may still be paying more. It's the percentage we're talking about that falls. Let me say one thing about this is a value judgment. And this is one place where, as somebody who's trying to be honest, the idea that the more successful, or others would say the luckier among us, should bear a larger cost of running our government is a value judgment. On the other hand, I don't see very many people telling me that they're in favor of regressive taxes. And I actually think that that's unfortunate, because I think there are, in fact, folks who are in favor of regressive taxes but don't like that word. I mean, after all, who wants to be regressive? What's it tell you if your kid regresses? That's not good. You'll hear the argument made in slightly different ways. Income taxes punish hard work. Right? That says we shouldn't ask people who make more income to make a larger contribution. I also think that what happens is, because people dislike defending the idea of a regressive tax, even though they're not really worried about regressivity, they go looking for other reasons not to like this tax. And an area where that occurs, I think, to some extent, is, for example, oh, there are these administrative costs of running this or that tax, which are often very small, really. So I want to make it clear, this is a value judgment. I think many people in the consensus that we are in favor of progressive taxes, I think, is not as broad as one would hear in the public discourse, just to be honest about it. And I think the choice of words, to some extent, drives that. Words matter in this business.
Is this clarification?
Clarification.
Go ahead, Representative Ortiz.
Is there any consensus amongst economists of which type of tax has a bigger drag on the economy or a bigger negative impact on the economy?
I don't think we're into clarification. We're asking a substantive. We want to get the clarification to the presentation. But say, write that down and sure. Ask it when we get them both up here. Thank you.
I thought I'd quickly run through the taxes. Not everyone is aware of, sort of, again, as a state that hasn't had broad-based income taxes or sales tax for 30-some years. You may not be aware of where Alaska actually is in comparison to other states. So let me quickly run through this slide. Alaska does have a corporate income tax. It maxes out at 9.4%, and it is actually among the four highest in the U.S. You do collect local property taxes, as you know. Alaska is unique in that it has communities that don't collect the property tax. In the rest of the U.S., virtually every community collects a property tax. So Alaska is unique, and you sometimes hear people say, oh, Alaska doesn't depend as much on the property tax. I actually got on some two or three listings that did a weighted average, and actually Alaska's property tax is slightly above average on most of these weightings. And I say, because here's the thing, while there are many communities that don't collect property taxes, most people live in communities that do collect property taxes, like Anchorage, obviously. And the property taxes in those communities are actually at or slightly above the national average. So most people in Alaska are paying property taxes that are near or slightly above the national average in terms of the property tax. I think that's worth understanding in terms of kind of where we are at the present.
And just to be clear, we only have about 10
sure.
minutes more to before we get questions or get through your...
As you know, you have the lowest fuel tax. We have the lowest fuel tax in the country. We don't have a vehicle excise tax. 25 states do. And 6 states don't have a personal income tax. Sales taxes are actually somewhat more complicated because there are a lot of variations on sales taxes. I'll just, rather than go through this in detail, say no other state has neither a sales tax nor a state lodging tax. There are some states that don't have sales taxes, but they all have other kinds of use taxes on top of them. I can come back and go through that in detail. To quickly talk about the various taxes and what economists would say are the kinds of high-level considerations, sales taxes are generally considered moderately regressive. That is, low-income people pay relatively more of them. That's because they spend more of their income. Exemptions like food tend to reduce regressivity, but they, of course, narrow the base, and so they collect less revenue at any given tax rate. An important point is if you're trying to implement the broad and low strategy for a sales tax, you do need to include services. Most states, or many states, do not include services, and this has been a real problem with their sales tax bases over time. I'd already mentioned the issue of competition from internet sales. Two points that I'll touch on each of the taxes. Part of a sales tax is paid for by the federal government because it can be deducted for itemizers. It's important to note only itemizers get that benefit, of course. And there is a substantial amount of taxes paid by tourists. However, this is actually an area where I talked with my staff yesterday. The truth is it is hard to get a good estimate in the case of sales taxes about how much is actually paid by both non-residents and by tourists. There are lots of different numbers. Every one of them has a problem with them. And I'll come back to what we think is sort of the summary on that for all of the taxes. The income tax can, by design, be progressive. That is why it is widely used, I think. As I mentioned, it can be quite distortionary, particularly when there are differential treatment of different kinds of income, like housing. Probably the issue that has received the greatest attention from income taxes is the impact that it can have on work decisions, especially second earners in a household. That is, if you have a couple who have children at home, and one of them has to decide, am I going to go to work or am I going to stay home? Well, I need to deduct my taxes. I need to deduct the cost of child care, the cost of a car, and so forth. And income taxes can and do make an impact. That is why, by the way, the federal government has the federal earned income tax credit specifically on that. Again, there's a federal deduction for itemizers, and we know that for wages, and I want to emphasize this is not all income, this is wages, covered employment. We know that about 15% of wages go to non-residents. With the federal income tax, a significant issue is coordinating with the federal income tax rate. All states use some definitions of federal income in defining their tax. Most states, and I apologize because I didn't put it on the handout, so I'll have to read it off my notes here. And that is that 30 states use adjusted gross income. That would be line 37 for those of you who file a 1040, and then adjust it in some way. So you add this in, take this back out. Seven states, by the way, they use adjusted gross income, and then they do their own deductions and exemptions. I believe it's seven states use the adjusted gross income, and they use exactly or almost exactly federal deductions and federal exemptions. So they're using federal taxable income. And you're thinking about, I believe it's like line 42 on the back of your 1040, for example. So 30 states use adjusted gross income. Another seven states use the federal taxable income. Five states either have their own definitions or readjust federal income in more complicated ways. And I should say that at present, and this was not true, by the way, when Alaska had an income tax last, at present no states define taxes using the federal tax liability as the starting point. And for Alaskans, it's perhaps worth pointing out that in 1980, there were only 24 states that had income taxes. The number's grown. And at that time, six states did use the federal tax liability. So if you're thinking back 30 years, about a quarter of the states did it the same way as Alaska did when you last had an income tax. If that helps you understand why, I think some of you think, oh, isn't this the way all states do it, that there has been a substantial change over the last 30 years. Property taxes, there's quite an argument about whether they're progressive or regressive. I could come back to that. It's due in part because property taxes are heavily paid by businesses. There's no question property taxes have some serious effects for those on fixed income. The obvious case is a retired person who still lives in a large house. And circuit breakers are widely used to reduce the regressivity of those taxes. Local property taxes at higher rates can create a tax competition for industry, and the effect of that tax competition is usually to reduce the base, that is to exempt some property from taxation. And again, this federal tax deductibility for itemizers.
And we have a clarification.
Clarification. Can you define circuit breakers?
Certainly. A circuit breaker is one that says, there are a variety of different ones, but they say, if your property tax is more than 2% of your income, the state will either, you don't have to pay that, or the state will pay it. So it caps your liability at some percentage of your income. And that's why it's called a circuit breaker.
And it, okay, and that, we're just talking about property taxes. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. By the way, there are lots of designs. In some cases, the circuit breaker just says the community can't collect the tax. In other cases, the state pays it. Some circuit breakers have similar provisions for rental.
Mm-hmm.
That we compute what we think the share of your rent was went to property taxes, and we have a similar sort of computation. But the general idea is to limit the amount that you are paying for property taxes to something that's related to your income. They are very widely used in the U.S. at present, although they take many shapes. The permanent fund dividend, it's probably worth noting, the permanent fund is by design a very progressive program. That is, you give the same amount of money to everyone, and so the low income are getting, as a percentage of their income, a very large share of their income. It is, by definition, a very progressive program. In fact, the only analogy to it is the very progressive social welfare systems of Northern Europe, where there are similar payments made to families, sometimes to children, sometimes to families, of lump sums for each family across the society. They're relatively unheard of in the rest of the U.S. So cutting the PFD is cutting a very progressive program and has a very regressive impact. PFD cuts are offset by the federal income tax. That is, that because when you don't receive the PFD, you don't receive income, you pay lower federal income taxes. Let me stick in a note here that gets back to my question about there's two ways that we shift our taxes to other payers. We have the federal government pay part of it by reducing our federal income taxes, or we have non-residents and tourists pay it by having them pay it directly. The work that ICER has done says that it's a little hard to estimate the amount that's paid by non-residents. The piece paid by itemizers the reduction of the property tax is very easy to calculate very, very accurately. From what we can see, it does not matter whether you raise property taxes, income taxes, or sales taxes, or whether you cut the dividend. Approximately 15% of that change will be paid either by the federal government through lower federal income tax corrections or by non-residents. In the case of the PFD, it's almost all through reductions in property taxes. For the other three, it's a share, and it varies a little across the different ones. But approximately, the impact in terms of how much of each of these would be paid by Alaskans, the answer is roughly 85%. Getting it more precise than that, if you're worried about 2 or 3 percentage points, there's a lot of work on the sales tax in particular. It's just really hard to get numbers that will tell us who really is paying the sales tax.
Clarification. Sure. Did you say approximately 15% of the PFD reduction is through property tax?
Excuse me, if I said federal income tax. Through federal income tax. If you think about that, that's because there are some people who have a zero tax rate and there are some people that have a 39% tax rate. You kind of average across that, it comes out to about 15%, just a little bit under. I'm going to skip the next couple of slides other than to say, with respect to state and local spending, because of the time, I've said this at a couple of places. I think it's obvious. But the reason that we want to hire a worker in the courts, a public worker in the court system, is not to keep that person employed to keep the economy going in the long run. We want to hire them because we value the services the courts provide us. We can't ignore in the short run that laying off a lot of people is going to have a very negative effect. But that's not our long-run goal. Our long-run goal is to look at the expenditures that we make and say, which of these do we value? How do we value the child protective workers and their very difficult job. How many of those do we really want? What value do they bring? What are we willing to pay for them? We're not hiring them simply to boost the economy. So I'll leave it with
clarification.
Sure.
Representative Ortiz.
So the term value in that sense, you're talking about not economic value, you're talking about value in terms of the other kind of value.
No, I think it is economic value. And let me say, and let me pick the court worker, for example. You say, what does a court worker give us? Well, talk with a lawyer who works in the state where the backlog is 2 years. And ask that lawyer what they would be willing to pay to have a backlog of 2 months. There's real economic value to having a well-functioning court system. It not only reduces the cost for lawyers, but it means the contracts we make elsewhere in the economy are easier to enforce. That's real value. It may be hard to measure, but it's value. And as my example there, I'm sure there are lawyers that would be willing to pay to get the docket speeded up. That is, after all, why in some cases they agree to go to private arbitrators and hire judges, right? So there is a value here. There's a difference between a value that's easy to measure and value. But that doesn't mean because it's not easy to measure that it's not value. I think that's an important point in thinking about these things. And by the way, just as a footnote, clearly many things that government do are hard to value, and value is to some extent in the eye of the beholder. Understand that. But it doesn't mean there's not value there. And I think I'll, just because I'm cognizant of the time, I'll skip through the rest of it and allow you to turn to questions. You have the whole PowerPoint.
You've got two slides left. Why don't you go ahead and just quickly run through them? So we.
Okay, in looking at spending cuts are obviously very complicated because it does matter what you cut. Different cuts will have different impacts both in the short run and the long run. Obviously, there are important details. Some of our programs are tied to federal receipts. We have, and if we cut a program that's receiving $2 of federal income for every dollar we spend, then we're not taking $1 out of the economy, we're taking $3. But I think the last two is probably more important, and that is that it is possible to cut state spending and shift the cost to other payers. The two easiest ones are in education. If we cut funding for K-12 education, and again, this is not, I say will, because I'm looking at what happened in the lower 48, where this was done a lot in the Great Recession. The impact is clearly to increase local taxes, who pick up more of the burden of paying for education. And again, in the lower 48, this is certainly not a policy I advocate, to be clear, but in the lower 48, support for higher education during the last 10 years dropped dramatically, and tuition costs went up dramatically, and you've seen that now in the form of a lot of publicity on the student debt crisis that's come out of that. So when you say cuts, I think it's important to recognize that these cuts do have impacts on Alaskans through Alaskans doing things to compensate for those changes. I've been asked what I would do for a plan, and as I've said at the beginning of the presentation, I'm not here to advocate for a specific plan, but I do think, thinking about it, that there are some elements that a plan will inherently involve, and I've put those five elements up on this slide. I don't think they're going to be any surprise. The first one is obviously how the permanent fund and related assets, because after all, the earnings reserve has a substantial amount of money in it, and there are some smaller savings accounts. But how the permanent fund will be used both to fund the dividend but also to fund government. So that's obviously a part of a fiscal plan. The second piece is how to manage volatility in the net revenues that the state gets from oil. I think that's obvious, and by net revenues, we obviously mean revenues after considering the effect of things like tax credits, for example. The third point is one that I just made, that we want multi-year expenditure plans ultimately that are based on the value we get from those services. What things do we value? What things don't we value? I think an important element of a plan is to let Alaskans know what is going to be our choices with respect to taxes or costs that are shifted to residents and businesses. And when I say role and timing, I mean, for example, if one were going to implement either a sales tax or an income tax. It strikes me that we're not going to get such a tax running prior to January 19th at the earliest, and maybe January 20th, for lots of reasons. In the case of the sales tax, a very important reason is if you implement a sales tax, we've got to give communities the opportunity to adjust what they're doing to coordinate with the state, however that happens, and that's not going to happen in 6 months. So looking at it, simply because we may need to implement a tax in 2019 or 2020 under a scenario doesn't mean we can put off the decision about when we're going to do it. So letting people know now, and again, the timing for these taxes may be we're going to phase them in two chunks. We're going to try to collect $200 million in a tax in 2 years and $300 million the year after. It does not necessarily have to be one huge chunk. But letting people know what to expect is important. And finally, the piece we touched on early in the really started the discussion with, and that is, how are we going, this is implicit in the rest of it, but there's really a decision, how are we going to use our savings, the earnings reserve in particular, to manage our way through the short-run challenges that we face? I see those as the components of a plan. There are many ways to put this plan together, but I think a long-run plan probably will touch on all of these.
Thank you very much. I think we are ready to have Dr. or Mr. come up. So we have two presentations, and you want to take the gavel back? We can have.
Okay, are there any questions of the committee?
Yeah.
I've got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in one of your slides, you had kind of one of your blips during the SB 21, not just the implementation of it, but then when it went to the ballot and after the ballot. So now that we changed some of it again last year, and then there's another bill this year, can we anticipate to see the same, you know, type of pullback, or was that one just so much more substantial it showed up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson. Oops. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, have I done this correctly?
Okay.
I think that you are thinking about employment in the oil and gas industry, correct? That's what you're saying, is the employment, year-over-year employment associated with kind of the fiscal environment for the oil and gas industry and how changes in the tax credit program will affect employment. That's where your question is.
Mr. Chairman, it's in the employment, but then if the employment falls, then I think you also talked about how spending and kind of the domino effect that happens as far as that goes as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, the oil space is incredibly complicated. And you know this. In addition to our tax structure, you have these companies that are making decisions really on an international basis as to where to deploy their assets. And so I think, you know, broadly, I think the industry has said, you know, the credits matter. And this is something that we and ICER and the staff at ICER have talked about, particularly after our last presentation, is that being said, it's very difficult to take A and point it directly at B in this case because it is such a complex space. And so the way economists say it is, it's very difficult to prove the counterfactual, which is what would it have been in the absence of X, Y, and Z. So in this case, we're talking about the absence of oil tax credits and what could happen in oil tax credits. I would say broadly that yes, particularly with the much smaller companies that you would expect a pullback because they're much more dependent upon those. But I think it gets to the longer term question of what is the value of those credits? Because the state probably has more efficient ways of increasing employment than giving tax credits to exploration and production companies. What the state should really be thinking about is what is the net present value of the new oil that is discovered because of those credits 5-10 years down the line, because that's really why we give the credits. We don't give the credits to boost short-term employment. We give the credits to make sure the pipeline stays full. And that is an incredibly difficult question to answer, because you can give those credits, but right now we don't have control over where the exploration happens and what type of find we make. So we have a wonderful discovery from Kalis. It happens to be very far away from the pipeline. Should that be valued in the same way as a smaller discovery that is right next to production facilities in the pipeline and will bring things in sooner? So it's a very challenging question, but I think the basic answer is yes, companies will respond, but I don't know anybody who's outside of the industry that has a great answer to the question of how will they respond and what will happen. I know that was a very long-winded way of getting back to that, but...
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson?
So in any of the graphs, and I think Fairbanks feels it more because of the subcontracting that comes from any development that happens specifically in the oil industry. So is through the graphs and the jobs, because they weren't kind of laid out that way, because you had oil, which kind of, I'm thinking more North Slope and what happens up in that area. So does any of the graphs that you've ever done actually show then the subcontracting part, you know, the smaller businesses that are actually in our communities and the production, you know, the production of jobs and revenue coming from that and the effects of how that goes up and down?
Thank you, Mr. King. I just wanted to mention, I'm sorry, I should have said this beforehand, but if we've got two male voices here and we're actually transcribing these, so just for transcription, if you could say your name prior to each answer. So appreciate it. Thank you. Representative Wilson or Mr. King?
This is Jonathan King responding. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Department of Labor records employment data by borough and census area. So in the place where we have formed boroughs, they report that data for the borough level. So in your example, it is possible to go to the Fairbanks North Star Borough and look at either what's called the quarterly census of employment and wages data or the monthly survey data, which is less accurate, and look at employment in those all of those individual sectors. That being said, you have to take it the next step further, which is to then analyze that data and look at both the effect of those, try to figure out what the effect of the credits are, and also figure out what the effect of the broader implications are of what's happening in the oil industry at that point. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you put the credits in, but at the same time the oil industry is, the price of oil is falling, you might not see any increase in employment. The increase is embedded in the fact that people weren't laid off until later on, and so it's actually a lack of evidence, a lack of change that is the evidence, and that gets into some pretty sophisticated modeling at that point to be able to say, yeah, this is definitely related to the oil tax credits.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got three questions: Representative Guerra, then Kawasaki, and then Ortiz.
Thank you. I'm sorry I stepped out, though I was watching you on TV, so you look the same, I think. You had mentioned, is it Dr. Townsend? Or
that's fine. Yes, it is Dr. Townsend.
Dr. Townsend, so obviously if we were to have an income tax just for a sense of easiness, the easiness would be for residents, it would be a percentage of your federal income tax, but you have mentioned that states have shifted away from that. Is that because they don't want to be dependent on the rise and fall of federal tax rates to determine their tax rate, or can you give us the reasons you've known,
sure,
even if there are many?
Well, two things. It's the difference. Back up. Certainly, a driver for states to implement their own definitions of deductions and exemptions and their own tax rates is for exactly the reason you're mentioning, and that is that if the federal government reduces its tax rates by 10%, the state does not suffer a similar 10% reduction. That is certainly a driver. And it allows states, for example, to make their own decisions about capital gains taxation versus other taxation. whereas if you use the percentage of the federal liability, whatever is built into the federal tax computations is there. So the ability to have control over what you're taxing, also more stability in your taxation, because the federal government often reduces its taxes, and it should reduce its taxes during a recession and raise them during good times. Well, that's the opposite of what states often need. But the last point is, actually, it's not really a lot more difficult to use adjusted gross income. Because what happens? You take your adjusted gross income figure, you go to a tax table, and it says you owe this much. It does not prevent you, by the way, if you were to say to me, well, I would like to have a tax that raises 15% of what the federal government does. That's pretty easy to do, and in fact, a few states do something close to that. And that is what you would do is you'd say, I'm going to write into my statute the definitions of income are per the federal definitions, my exemptions and deductions are per the federal exemptions, and then I'm going to have a tax schedule that if the first bracket is 10%, then mine is 1.5%. Right, 1.5% will raise 15% of what 10% will do. So writing a statute that says for the typical taxpayer, you will pay 15% of what you pay on your federal tax is not very difficult. It does not raise the compliance costs very much. What people forget is that there are a lot of reasons for separating out deductions and exemptions and so forth. And the most important one is that 20% of your taxpayers are going to be part-year residents. And you've got to go into the complication of how do I allocate their income? How do I allocate their exemptions? And most states want control of that rather than control of that in the calculations of the exemptions and the deductions. And so for a lot of reasons, I think states have found that the administration for the average person is a little bit more complicated, but not very much. And moreover, most states find there are a lot of details that they can handle by having their own details. That doesn't stop you from saying, if you're putting forward a proposal, to say, I am putting forward a proposal which for somebody who earns, whose salaries are entirely, whose income is entirely wages and salaries and interest, they will pay exactly 15% of the federal tax. You can design such a tax system and still not use it based on the bottom line. And that is what essentially states try to do, or some states try to do.
Hello, Representative Garrett?
I guess so. So you're saying that you come up with your own tax table that will, let's say you wanted to tax at some rate similar to 15% of a federal tax liability, you're saying you come up with your own tax table that can mimic that. But then I guess if it's a tax table based on adjusted gross income, as federal and state federal taxes go up and down, yours stays stable. Is that what you're saying?
Well, two things. Your what most states do at present is they coordinate some aspects. The definition of income is often exactly the same as the federal definition. On deductions and exemptions, they sometimes say it will be exactly the same as the federal. In other cases, they say we will write it in statute every couple of years, and they decide whether they want to follow the federal changes. Remember that when you because I was not in Alaska in 1980, but when there was last an income tax here, there were not substantial credits below the taxes paid for the typical taxpayer. Now you have the child care credit, the college credit, which substantially reduces it. So when the government brings that in, when the federal government brought that in, if a state had defined it on tax liability, you would have adopted those credits. Whereas states that have their own system would then decide, do we want that particular credit or not? So they're making decisions about the extent to which they want to follow changes in the federal government tax.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. We've got a question from Representative Kawasaki and then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in 2000 and 2011, Representative Pruitt and I sat on a committee chaired by Representative then Fairclough, now Senator McKinnon, it was the House Special Committee on Fiscal Policy. We discussed all of the things that we're still discussing today. I think in the end, the committee, I don't know that the committee actually did anything at the end, other than we talked about this idea that we need to do something now, but we had 20... Well, I've seen it. We had $20 billion in the bank. We just paid our CBR. We had so much money outflow of the CBR, we created a statutory budget reserve, and there wasn't really an appetite to take up any of the ideas that we'd come up with. So now we're here in a recession, and, of course, recessions track a year later. We found out. We can feel it, but nobody could give us proof. What I'm worried about is I know that people think that we can write the state out of recession tomorrow. I feel it's like we're the Exxon Valdez. We've run aground already. Or we're headed into the ground. What's the best way to not harm the economy or to flip back from a recession the fastest? Because we talk about income taxes will take money out of the economy. Taking a PFD will take money out of the economy. Increasing oil taxes could potentially deflate investment in the state. So that's really what I'm focused on, is how we get out of the recession the fastest. Thank you.
Mr. King?
This is Mr. King, through the chair. I think that one of the things that we have to recognize is that the opportunity to get out of the recession the fastest has gone by, and that the opportunity for action was actually several years ago. And the emphasis, I think, going forward should be what is the Alaska that we want to live in, and what does it look like? And without doing additional harm, substantial additional harm to the economy. We have, in some ways, squandered that opportunity, and the opportunity to come back out is unfortunately an exogenous event, which is a return on oil prices. At this point, because we have not adopted an annuity-type approach where we stabilized spending some time ago by using our permanent fund earnings reserve and rolling in the constitutional budget reserve and what was left of the statutory budget reserve, we now face an issue where we are going to stabilize or could stabilize state spending at a much relatively lower level, and we have to wait for a return in oil prices. We can't invent an industry that generates as much revenue, and so I think I would say, Dr. Townsend's advice. Dr. Townsend has not been in Alaska a particularly long time, but in working with him and appearing with him a couple of times, I have become deeply impressed by just this kind of the sage wisdom of the advice that he's giving, right? And so this broad and low idea of introducing people to the idea that they have to pay for their services, and then also trying to figure out from Alaskans what are the services that the state really needs to provide, and provide them well. Figure out what you're going to do and do it well so that people have confidence in their state government. And the broad cut approach that we've taken over the last couple of years has really not answered the question of what should we be doing and what should we be doing well. And so now we're in a position where herring fisheries don't happen, runs in Bristol Bay don't get harvested, and that takes money out of local economies, takes money out of local citizens' pockets, and it reduces fish taxes, which flow to the state. Probably not an optimal way to be managing the Department of Fish and Game. So I would say that we recognize that that opportunity has gone by, and we start adapting to the future and start thinking about the economy holistically, and perhaps Dr. Townsend can add to that.
This is Ralph Townsend. I guess I'd add to that in the following way. I think it's clear that if we try to solve all of the budget crisis in 2 years, as Jonathan's numbers showed, we're going to end up with a four-year recession. And I'm quite concerned that a four-year recession could, for example, have negative impacts on the housing market, and that we would be in a really risking a much going from what has been so far uncomfortable, but still not as bad a recession as the rest of the U.S. had in the Great Recession. So I think being a track of adjusting the budget that says we're going to get there over some period of time, 5 years or whatever, and saying it would really be impossible, I think, to implement any tax by January of 18 anyways. So saying if we're going to use a tax, if a tax is one of our strategies, whichever tax it is, that in 19 or 20, we're going to, part of getting back to that is raising $200, $300 million in this or that tax, is part of setting that future out. So it's, and the reason why this is important is because the one thing we want to happen is for people who make investment decisions to have some confidence to make those decisions. That's the piece that we can control. If we continue to insist that they live in a world of uncertainty, this is a real issue. Think of yourself as a company who's thinking about investing in a highly capital-intensive industry. And you're thinking about laying out $5 million for an investment, and you're saying, are my taxes in this town going to be $50,000 a year, or are they going to be $100,000 a year? Right now, quite honestly, if I'm sitting out there, if I look at the state budget and I say, is there a way to cut $1 billion? There's only one path there. It's through K-12 funding. I can see that. And I'm not the only one who can see that. And so if I'm a business, I can sit there and say there is a significant probability that 5 years from now, the plant that I'm building for a 25-year life will face property taxes that are 50% higher. So that's what we mean by creating certainty. And not just certainly for the oil and gas industry, although that's important, but certainty for all investors so that they'll make those decisions that will help us come out of the current recession.
Thank you. The time is 3:30. We'll continue on. We do have two more questions from Representative Ortiz and then Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the importance of the tax rates being broad and low. You also have a bullet that says corporate income tax in the state of Alaska is 9.4%, which is among the four highest in the country. Have you looked at whether that corporate income tax is broad? In other words, do we have a lot of loopholes in that corporate income tax where some corporations end up not paying any taxes or a lot less than the 9.4%?
Are you an expert in that area? I'm not.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jonathan King, Representative Ortiz. I am an owner of an S corporation. To my knowledge, I do not particularly pay taxes to the state of Alaska, because the way that an S corporation works is that the decisions that I make flow to my personal income taxes. So, there are many of us that are S corps and LLCs who get taxed in that manner, and we don't pay a corporate income tax. However, if you instituted both an S-corp, expanded the corporate income tax definition to include S-corps and included an income tax, we would end up paying twice. Actually, if you included a sales tax, we'd end up paying thrice. So I don't think actually we're not opposed to, say, paying a sales tax and paying an income tax. I like having the Minnesota Drive plowed when I drive from South Anchorage into downtown. My kids happen to go to school in downtown, and getting them there safely is priority number one every morning. I don't mind paying for that. And so, yes, there are corporations which do not pay that. And a lot of us are located in the professional business sector. And I think a lot of us are willing to pay the taxes. We just want to make sure that that I think, like everybody else, we want the burden to be spread, right? So...
Thank you. And just on the side there, the 9.4% includes oil companies, except that it is worldwide apportionment. So at the last roundup, it was they were paying 4.4% a couple of years ago on the average, and most are paying zero now. So it depends on their profitability, because that's what and their worldwide profitability, not just their profitability in Alaska. I had a couple questions, and one was trying to institute a tax in a reasonable time frame. We were looking at an income tax as 15% of federal tax due, and the reason for that is because if you take and have to decide every deduction and every exemption, every one of those decisions is a long time in the making. And so I guess, do you also feel that each one of those where you have control of making each one of those exemption and deduction decisions becomes just almost as big a problem and as question as deciding on the tax itself?
Representative Seaton, I think you're directing that to me. This is Ralph Townsend. You can adopt, and I think this was the point I was trying to respond to earlier to Representative Gara, you could adopt the federal definitions of deductions and exemptions, which many states do. They don't have to be, they can be written into the code the same way. I file taxes in a number of states. My form for state taxes in most states, I fill out about four lines. Why do I fill out four lines? I put in federal adjusted gross income. I think that's what I've used in most states. Most states have some small adjustments around things like taxes paid on state and local bonds. You're familiar with under the federal tax code, state and local bonds are exempt. States often tax them. They may treat income earned in other states slightly differently, so there are small adjustments. But it's really, it's, I guess, two things. Designing a tax so that you can say to consumers or to citizens, my tax is going to raise, for people who earn only salaries and interest, my tax is going to raise exactly 15% of the federal income tax, is a straightforward exercise. And that's in terms of communicating with people, because there's two separate issues. One is communicating today about what my tax will do. And the other one is administering the tax going ahead. And my point is, it is possible to design a tax that would be 15% or 6%, whatever the number is, by the way you design the tax brackets. But that still gives you the latitude to deal with credits, how you treat capital gains and other kinds of special taxes. It gives you the possibility of not subjecting yourself to the alternate minimum tax calculations that federal taxpayers must calculate. So it does give you in the long and it gives you a structure that deals much more easily with part year residents, which are 20% of your tax, which will be by the way. We know that 20% of covered employees are non-residents or part-year residents from the wage data. The prior data is much harder to figure out what's going on. I'm not sure I answered your question, though.
No, I guess the question that I was trying to get to was your other point about how people get around taxes and lobbyists and how much lobbyists are in, and every decision that we have to make on every one of those brackets, on every one of those, once those decisions are open for decision making, it means we are imperiled because of the lobbying effort of all of the interests that would be coming forward to get those exemptions or those credits or those deductions. And whether that we, by making ourselves flexible, we almost kill our opportunity to proceed in a fast way because of the lobbying efforts on each individual aspect.
Through the chair, this is Mr. King. You know, I think actually if you're going to attach it to a percentage of federal liability, you're very likely to have those discussions because there's going to be battles about the adjustments that occur there. I think, you know, I too have lived in a number of states, and I remember, although I was much younger, living in North Carolina, my first professional job outside of school, I do remember that the income tax form was about that big, and it was on adjusted gross income, and they just made sure that they set their, without any deductions, and they just made sure that they set their rates to achieve the effect that they wanted. It is relatively easy to look at the structure of the federal tax rates and set a 15% of that rate of what, not the raw rate, but what of people actually end up paying as a portion of their income. We know the average taxpayer in the United States pays 14.5% of their income. That does not mean that they are in the 15% tax bracket. It is relatively easy to look at the structure of that data and be able to design those rates. Another point that I'll make that hasn't been raised, but just to make it quickly, is I gave pretty much the same presentation that I gave to you today to the Alliance, the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, and I got an email last night from one of the Alliance members asking me some questions, and he asked about an income tax, and the question that he asked was, well, if we adopt an income tax, doesn't that mean that half the people don't pay? And it's very true that because of the earned income tax credit, it's been a very successful program, that half of citizens essentially have no federal income tax liability because they're too poor to pay federal income taxes. If you adopt the federal percent of federal liability, you are adopting the federal policy, for good or for bad, that half of the potential taxpayers don't pay. Whereas if you put them in adjusted gross income and it is important to you that the majority pay or a certain percentage pay, and so it feels like it's a shared burden, you have the flexibility to do that under adjusted gross income in a greater way than you do in adopting a percentage of federal liability. So there are a lot of advantages to being under adjusted gross income, and that's the reason that states have transitioned to adjusted gross income versus percent of federal tax liability.
Thanks, and although we don't have any bill before us, it is interesting that we have a minimum tax in there, so everybody would be a contributor. But I did have one more question. That's on slide 9 of the ICER presentation. So when we're talking about making sure that we have inflation calculated, does that mean that since we have 6.95% and we're looking at 2.25%, as the inflation rates in most of the models, that the revenue source book and its calculation of oil price over time, does that mean we have to deduct 2.25% annual from that, or do we add 2.25%? Or is it already calculated in there?
Representative Seaton, this is Ralph Townsend. This is a very good question, because sorting out what a third party has done in their calculations to get to 6.9%, for example, is not easy. They may not tell you what they are forecasting for inflation. In the oil forecast, remember how the oil, correct me, Jonathan, the oil forecast is still done by committee? Is that, am I not correct? Is a committee that creates an oil forecast for the administration?
The Department of Revenue just changed their mechanism for doing it.
But my point being that you get a group of people and you say, what's your best guess about the future of oil? And in that calculation, they are implicitly somehow thinking about lots of things, including inflation. They may not be separating it out, though, right? And so getting them to say, well, when you did that calculation for the future price of oil, what were you assuming about inflation? And they may say, well, we were assuming some.
That would be a question we will be asking the Department of Revenue.
And so it's
Well, not really. This is something where I have real sympathy for the folks doing this, that we are taking numbers from two or three different, and I'm not criticizing any one of the numbers. For the purpose for which it was constructed, it may be the right thing to do. But when we pull them all together, we then have to say, are they comparable? The biggest one, though, is certainly if you can see, if at a minimum you can see, clearly there's inflation in the return on the permanent fund. 6.9% is not a real return. It's too high. When you see revenues growing, our population isn't growing, so there's probably some inflation in there. That's telling you on the revenue side you've got inflation. When you tell me that government spending is dead flat, remember, you're telling me that government spending is falling by 2% a year. And I think that's the most important message, that when somebody sees this dead flat line, you think, oh, that would be easy for us to do. No, you'll be in here every session cutting 2% in real services to stay on that line. And I think that has been, at least in the forecasts I've seen so far, and I want to be clear, I could easily make that same mistake, sitting down doing a spreadsheet and say, because unless you have people stepping back and saying, what's really in these numbers? And I raise this issue on inflation only because I have seen several forecasts, including at least one before this committee, that said government spending will be dead flat going ahead, and everything else was going up at the rate of inflation. And I wanted to say, remember, that implies government is falling at the rate of inflation.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Were there any, so I guess it is, we're over time. You have a question?
I had a couple of questions, Mr. Chair, but if you want to end the committee meeting, I understand.
Do you want to go ahead and pose those questions so the committee will know and we can discuss?
Yeah, this is one question for Mr. King. You said something on the corporate tax. If there were a tax on S corporations and then an income tax, you would get a credit so you weren't paying twice, so you don't have to pay twice. We've thought about that.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah. Mr. Townsend, Representative Seaton has a really important point, which is we don't want to get mired in huge lobbying fights in China if we pass an income tax, and we want it to be fair. So is it possible to forget about having arguments over huge numbers of different deductions? He has a proposal that would be something like 15% of your federal income tax, so I don't know, like roughly a 4% tax or something like that, 3% tax on average. But could you just go to each bracket and say, let's say one of the brackets is 39%, figure out what 15% of that is, and say at that income level it's 5.4%, and if the bracket is 25%, at that income level, it's 3.3%. So you would mimic the 15% income tax within the brackets, but have your own tax rate so that when federal taxes go up and down, your taxes don't go up and down. Is that easy?
This is Ralph Townsend. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying that you can do to get there. And it is, again, the test for me is the rest of the U.S. has a lot of experience with income taxes, income tax administration, and they have all moved away from the percentage of the federal tax for a variety of reasons. It is possible to design a tax that does exactly 15% of the federal income tax collections for the typical taxpayer, but have a structure where you deal with the atypical taxpayer within that structure. Having said that, allow me to agree with Representative Seaton that one of the things I have to concede about an income tax versus any other tax is that an income tax, almost any way you design it, is going to encourage what economists call rent seeking, which is investing in lawyers and lobbyists to be treated differently under the code. It is what's wrong with our federal tax code. I can't deny that even though my personal preferences, because of progressivity, probably would go to the income tax. I have to concede that one of the great liabilities of the income tax is that the rent-seeking has created at the federal level a tax code that does not, in my opinion, does not serve us very well. And you're quite correct, it seems to me, you are going to see those same forces at the state level. Having said that, the lower you can keep the tax rate,
the less you will be subject to those kinds of things. But I think it's an inevitable part, and it's one of those equity efficiency trade-offs, I think, that goes with the income tax.
Okay, well, thank you very much. The committee sure appreciates you staying a little longer, and the committee members, is there, if people want to talk after, you'll be available, I hope. And
thank
we
you.
Will be adjourned at 3:47.